Committee on Education, Friday, April 1st, 2005, 1 o'clock p.m., hearing room E. House Education Committee. Expanded version before you then continue on with the acronyms. That would be helpful. Thank you very much. Today we are going to have a little change in order. We'll have a public hearing on House Bill 3151 first. Then we will move to a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3168. We'll then move to 3154 number 3, and we'll wind up with House Bill 2967. Does that work?
Good.
We will hold open a public hearing on House Bill 3151, and Mr. Kelly, we'll give us an overview.
House Bill 3151 requires school districts with certain number of students and specified percentage of students who qualified for the federal school lunch program during the prior school year to provide lunches to eligible students. Because of an emergency effective July 1, 2005, it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Representative Clark.
Thank you. And then finally, Madam Chair, may I have permission to invite James Dowdy and Heidi Dupuy from the Department of Ed's Nutrition Program to join me?
Certainly. And as well as permission to use visual aids.
Okay.
I'd like to ask permission for that too. Thank you.
Can I have
a mic? Yes, absolutely. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Farr. I'm State Representative for House District 14. One out of every three kids in Lane County comes from a family that will access a food box this year. And Lane County isn't much different from the counties most of you represent. Those children qualified for free and reduced-priced lunch at the school they attend. But did you know that some school districts in Oregon don't provide a lunch program? Even though the USDA has subsidies that allow them to provide lunch to students at almost no cost. We talk a lot in this building about education, but if educating kids is a priority, then feeding kids should also be a priority, since statistically we know that hunger is a major impediment to learning. Some people say that schools shouldn't be in the business of feeding kids, but if we provide transportation, because we know we can't teach kids who aren't at school, and we provide teachers and textbooks to present the curricula we want kids to learn, then shouldn't we be providing basic nutrition so that the dollars that have already been spent aren't wasted? There are a lot of dumb ways to save money, but not feeding children is about the dumbest. And that's not my quote, by the way. Have any of you ever been hungry? If you have ever skipped a meal, you know that when you are hungry, it is very difficult to concentrate and stay on task. Easy to see why hungry kids are performing behind their peers who are at the same grade level. One of the arguments given for not providing food is that food preparation facilities no longer meet code, or schools don't have facilities at all. But other schools with these obstacles have found a way to provide food by contracting out their lunch program to other school districts, assisted living centers, food banks, and in some cases, restaurants. To meet the USDA's nutrition requirements, lunches don't have to be hot. Lunch can be as simple as a sandwich, vegetables, fruit, and milk. And I brought a visual aid, and thank you, Madam Chair, for noticing and giving permission. I want to show you, this is the kind of lunch that could be provided by an outside agency. Notice the little to-go container. And if my fingernails work, I can probably get it open. There we go. This is a tuna salad sandwich. We've got vegetables with ranch dip, banana, and 2% milk. And I want to leave you with my quote for the day. When we feed a belly, we must also feed a mind.
Thank you, Representative Farr. I think that we'll continue with the other panelists, and then we'll address our questions once you've completed.
Madam Chair Flores and members of the committee, I am Heidi Dupuis. I work for the Oregon Department of Education in the Office of Finance and Administration Child Nutrition Programs. I'm a child nutrition specialist, and I'm the team lead for the National School Lunch Program. Actually, let me back up. I'm the team lead for the school nutrition programs that include the National School Lunch Program, the School Breakfast Program, the Special Milk Program. And under National School Lunch Program, we also have the After School Snack Program and the Summer Seamless option that allows sponsors to provide summer meals to students without having to change the body regulations within which they work. And I'm here today to provide you with information.
The first bill we have, the public bill is 2680. John, you're going to give us a little rundown. Mr. Chair, this is a very simple bill. I'm just concerned that it's extensive.
Was that an April Fool's joke? Well, there's a little gremlin, but thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, Heidi, you have
In Oregon, we have 199 school districts, and of those, 181 participate in the National School Lunch Program, 5 in the Special Milk Program, and 13 in the do not have any federal program at all. And up until 1981, a school district could participate in both the National School Lunch Program and the Special Milk Program. The Special Milk Program provided reimbursement for the milk portion, and then the National School Lunch Program did the rest of the meal. And in 1981, those were separated out so that the reimbursement for the National School Lunch Program included the milk as well, so that increased cost to school districts and decreased the reimbursement. In my written testimony, I also provided you with two attachments. One is a list of the school districts that do participate in the National School Lunch Program, as well as a list of those school districts with enrollment under 200, and a list of school districts that do not participate in the National School Lunch Program. As part of the bill, four school districts would be affected: Alcee, Powers, Lowell, and Pleasant Hill. And because their enrollment is over 120. And the only district that is not providing anything for their students under a federal program is ALSEE. I believe that the community is providing some type of food during the school day for their students, but it's not as part of the National School Lunch or Special Milk Program. And Powers, Will, and Pleasant Hill all participate in the Special Milk Program. Thank you for hearing my testimony today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll get started, and then move to questions.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Joyce Doherty, and I direct the Child Nutrition Programs, which include the National School Lunch Program, as well as the Center Food Service Program and the Child and Adult Daycare Food Program. I'm here to answer any questions that you might have in terms of all of the child nutrition programs.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Munch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned four. I didn't get them written down. But if we lowered the number to, say, 100, when I went to a small two-room school, and we had less than 100 students, we had lunches, and they were provided. So how many schools would we pick up if we ratcheted down?
Madam Chair, Representative March, my understanding is that for a school to be able to break even under the guidelines, they would need to have at least 120 students, and that was why I added the amendment to the bill of 125 or more students.
Okay.
Let's see. I think this is the list here. Jordan Valley and Paisley. Well, actually, Jordan Valley is the only one that falls into the over 100 requirement, but under the 125 that isn't currently offering the program.
Right. Thank you.
Additional questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this bill require them to use the federal government programs, or does this require that they have lunch programs?
The way the bill is written, it would require them to participate in the United States Department of Agriculture program, and I violated the the acronym rule, so I owe it back. I did it before, and revealing that I'm fessing up. I would be willing to amend the bill to state that if a school district can demonstrate that they're providing adequate nutrition to their students, if they find another source to do it through community support, perhaps a grant, a private grant, then we would be willing to exempt them from participating in the program, but they would have to provide documented evidence to support the nutrition of kids.
Yeah, it's kind of a follow-up to separate questions, I think maybe to our expert. Is there prevailing evidence that having good nutrition at the elementary and particular level, and even earlier, that precludes problems later on, both with mental development as well as physical development? Or do you know?
Chair Flores and Representative Roblin, there is research that children that receive nutritionally adequate meals from birth through, particularly through their adolescence, that they perform better in schools. It's part of that supports the growth and development of the child. Of course, just food alone isn't going to assure academic excellence, but it is one of the building blocks for making sure that children are coming to school and being able, while in school, to perform at their top ability.
Further questions? Ms. Dupuy, you mentioned that ALSI school does not provide under the federal program. They have an alternative source. So kind of going back to Representative Farr's suggestion of some sort of an exemption, how does that school district go about providing their nutrition programs?
Madam Chair, over the several years with ALSI, they have a very old physical plant that requires renovation to be able to participate in the National School Lunch Program, but they have a very dedicated parent and community groups that come in and provide meals to their students. And where they get the funds, I do not know the source of their funds, but they do have a community group that comes in and prepares meals for their children.
So it's all parents and community.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that encouraging to know that a community will come together like this? Additional questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to give testimony in House Bill 3151? Hearing none, we'll close the testimony. Thank you. Sit down and give us your name for the record.
I'm so sorry.
I'm just
really nervous about doing this.
You'll do just fine.
Okay.
We're just here to have a discussion.
All right. Good afternoon.
For the record, you can move that microphone in front of you if you like, and then you can just give us your name for the record.
I'm Susie Johnston, and I live in Pleasant Hill, and I also serve as a school board member for that district. And I'm here today just as kind of a mom and a parent and with a little bit of a policy hooked on the thing. So, student kids in our district has been an issue for a very long time. We moved into Pleasant Hill School District about 18 years ago. My husband and I own our three kids. We have a first grader, a sixth grader, and a junior in high school. And so one of the first things that we noticed right off the bat, besides coming into an excellent school district, is that there wasn't a hot lunch program. And so in my tenure working with the parent group down at Trent Elementary, which is kindergarten through third grade, it was the parents that provided lunches for kids out of donations. That also happened at the elementary school to a certain level. At the junior high and high school, we have canteens, so it's sort of an a la carte thing. One of the things I think that you can notice that's happened in the time that I've lived there is the lunch programs, volunteer-driven and run, kind of peak and valley. And every time there's a peak, you can name that peak after a person who has been devoted to making sure that those kids ate and got a lunch. As often, you know, as often as we could sort of make that happen with the funds that we could raise to do that. To a certain degree, it's, you know, the money that we bring in for the lunches that helps pay for the free lunches that we provide. So it's not a profit-making business. Currently, Trent School, again, that's kindergarten through third grade, is providing lunch 2 days a week. And everything that comes in is a pre-cooked luncheon. So, you know, if there's like a hot item, maybe chips, fruit, and then and those kids that are receiving free milk are receiving free lunches. And we're currently distributing what are my figures? I think they're at 23 right now at Trent. At the elementary school, the parent group there is able to provide lunch 5 days a week. Again, those items are pre-cooked, and we're providing lunches for about 25 kids, and the numbers sort of fluctuate, but that, those are the ones that receive free lunches.
Who does the cooking and preparing?
Well, it's pre-cooked, and so we have warming ovens, those kinds of things, and we have parents pick it up and shop for the best deals they can to get it at that food. At the elementary in Trent, you know, it's either for fruit, it's fruit cups or fresh fruit, something in that order. So we're trying to do that. They usually get some chips, or crackers and peanut butter, and things like that.
Chips are probably on the forbidden list.
They're probably not. That's in the other room.
That's right.
You know, right? So we just ignore them. Pardon me. One of the things that we're doing with some of the extra money that comes in, and not all of it, but some of the money that comes in kind of goes either to the office, where kids, if they come in and they're hungry in the morning, or they haven't gotten a lunch or something like that, or the days that, particularly at Trent, because we serve 2 days a week, and, you know, there's 3 other days when we have hungry kids, you know, there's things in the office, like, they can get in and maybe heat up a burrito, or there's a cup of soup, or there's oatmeal. You know, there's some different food items and stuff that kids can go to the office in. And, you know, it's a small school district, so the people that need to know sort of have an awareness of which kids need to sort of be watched out for. And then they kind of take care of them that way. The junior high and the high school is a little different because we have a canteen. And so we have one staff person that works at both of those schools, one each. And then they have either student help, and I think the junior high has some extra parent help. One of the things that I think is pretty commendable that the woman that's running the canteen at the high school has done, she's worked there for 8 years, and she felt that part of this is it really does give students a chance for to respect themselves and be respected when they're working in the program. But they're required to get a food handler's license before they can continue to work in the kitchen. So they sort of start out, and then between a home ec department and a coffee cart, you know, they can be tested and go through the steps they need to go to gain that. So it's all right on campus. And then for some kids, well, that would have been sort of a big step and a frightening thing. They have that food handler's card, and they can go out and get a job, and they've done that. So, you know, it's been sort of one of the positive things. I don't have all the prices on the food at the junior high and high school, but it's a la carte, and I think it probably ranges in from $1.25 for hot items, and then depending on what items you buy. At Trent, you know, they're providing, the lunch we provide 2 days a week is $1.50. At the elementary school, it runs around $2. We get lunches in from two different places, Subway sandwiches and On the Way Market. And those lunches, depending on if you're a first grader or not, only with a small little deli sandwich, and get that is probably in the range of about $2.50. And then for kids that are ordering a full sandwich, it's over $3. And at the high school, and I asked the woman that runs the program there, how many kids came to school hungry? She said every single one of them in high school came to school. I'm thinking that probably could be up to $5. That's per day and per child, per week, per month. So when you factor in things like you have a mom that is driving 40 miles round trip to her job, her full-time job, and she has 5 children in the school district, and at Trent, because she has young children, you know, they get free lunch 2 days a week. It is a huge stress. And all 5 of her children are eligible for the free lunch programs throughout the district, but one they're only able to provide lunch 2 days a week. And, it's a huge strain if you have to order in lunches or do anything like that for your kids when it's not provided at a reasonable rate.
So, Ms. Johnson, are you presuming you testify in support of this bill?
Pardon?
Are you testifying in support of this bill?
Well, that part is a yes. Now, if I could just add my school board hat just a little bit. Sorry. Because I was counseled at the school board meeting on Monday evening and reminded that I'm speaking as an individual citizen. I'm not for the school district, I'm not as a school board member. I want to be cognizant of that. But, you know, the big things that we have kind of in our face are we don't have a kitchen. And probably, although we have people, when they're serving food, they have their food handler's card. We don't have a standard facility. We don't have a kitchen. If we start setting the quality under different guidelines, it would be very problematic for us. There's operational costs to doing that, and there's staff things. At Trenton Elementary, those two schools cover kindergarten through sixth grade with a 2-year junior high. So the EA at the high school and the EA at the junior high school, most of their cost to hire them, is covered somewhat by the profits of what they're generating out of those two canteens. So
if you're concerned that you might not, I was going to ask Representative Farr to go ahead and maybe respond to your concerns that we're hearing.
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes.
Would you like to do that?
Yeah, what I wanted to say, Ms. Johnson, thinking about that, is that there are some other school districts in the state that have the same impediments that Pleasant Hill has, either outdated kitchen facilities or, as in your case, no kitchen facilities. I know the Canby Elementary School, I believe, just recently started contracting out for their lunches. In Bethel, I just wanted to give you a little bit of information. Last school year, they received $22,000in matching funds from the state, which is about 5 cents per meal. And they break even on the program, which is good news. In the data that I collected from the Department of Ed, it appeared that to break even, you needed to have at least 125 students or more in the school district. But just to give you an idea of what the USDA program reimburses, and I think I can use USDA now that I actually said it stands for the United States Department of Agriculture. For the free lunches, USDA reimburses $2.25. For children who qualify for reduced lunches, $1.86. And then because the requirement is that the lunch be provided to kids that can afford to pay for the lunch as well, it's 23 cents. In Becker right now, at the elementary level, they charge $1.40 for lunches, $1.75 for middle school lunches, and $2 for high school lunches. Excuse me, the USDA commodity program also provides 16 cents per meal if the school participates in the program, and they provide things such as ground beef, cheese, and canned vegetables. And my understanding is that for the summer lunch program, or the after-school program, I guess they don't have to provide the food on site. They can get a cash reimbursement. And so I'm looking at Ms. Dupuy and Dowdy on that, if you can answer that question.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Heidi Dupuy from the Oregon Department of Education. Madam Chair and Representative Farr, for the summer food service program, that there is a small value, 1.5 cents in commodities that are earned for the meals that are served. If they operate their summer program under the National School Lunch Program, those meals earn the commodity rate at the 16 cents. And if the sponsor also participates in the supper program through CACFP, then they get cash in lieu of commodities.
Okay. Do you think it's possible that for school districts who can't participate in the program because they're contracting out for the lunches, that they could get a cash reimbursement?
No, because they have to meet the USDA guidelines for the nutrition content of the meal, but in listening to Ms. Johnston's testimony, that her program is so close, she didn't have to change almost anything except go under the National School Lunch Program and be able to receive those reimbursements. But particularly at the elementary level, the middle and the high school level, with the amount of, depends on the percentage of free and reduced, that the cash contributions from the paying kids and the reimbursement for those meals, that they would be getting added revenue to their program and doing that. And they can, there's a myriad, you do not have to have a kitchen to participate in the National School Lunch Program. Other school districts can provide the meals. You just need to have a way to keep them cold or hot with them, and there's a myriad of equipment that you can buy doing that at a very modest cost that will meet those requirements. So a kitchen should not be an impediment to participation.
Well, thank you very much. And it sounds like you should get together with the Department of Education, and then we can work out a positive outcome here, bring some more money into your district, which is always a nice thing. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnston.
And if you'd state your name for the record when you get started.
My name is Paula Soto, and I've lived in the Pleasant Hill School District for 15 years. I'm also a family support worker with Community Safety Net and work with family resource centers. And I'm not on school board, so I don't have to be as cautious. And I think Susie painted a little more glowing picture of our lunch program than perhaps others would. We do have food service at the tent, which is a K-3 school this year, because we have a volunteer who's committed to doing that. Most years, it's not been that wonderful. You know, it might be a corn dog is what they could purchase. At a 4-5-6 school, it's a la carte, so kids choose what they want to purchase. If they want to choose 2 bags of chips and no protein, that's what they choose, and they put it with the can of Coke that they bought from home. So, you know, the nutrition is an issue. That's not, you know, what this is not as good as if we have our regular hot lunch program. And I was going to speak about just a few other things. We know that giving the kids breakfast and lunch improves their academic, improves their test scores, and improves their school experience. And I think that there's a lot of kids, you know, they didn't, it's not the kids' fault they live in Pleasant Hill at all. And Pleasant Hill has a like, I think 1040 around that for Norman, and they have a little more than 300. So the 1,400 kids that live in the area, the kind of that I serve as a family support worker, I see lots of those kids who don't have adequate nutrition at home and they're not getting it at school. And as expenses go up, as gasoline costs more, there's even less money for food. And even if mom gets a food box, that's only twice a month at the local food bank, and it's just not adequate. So we know that it helps their academic performance. Just one other note, I spoke with a woman who works in our resource room. Actually, this was a year ago when she worked there. 9 first graders coming in for reading in the resource room. Only one of them had breakfast. And so Susan and I tried to scrounge up some food. We'd get some things from Fifth and Lane County or others to try to get the kids some yogurt or whatever we could scrounge up for them, because it really did affect their academic performance. It also affects their behavior. That's what they choose, and they put it with the can of Coke that they bought from home. So, you know, the nutrition is an issue. That's not, you know, what this is not as good as if we have our regular hot lunch program. And I was going to speak about just a few other things. We know that giving the kids breakfast and lunch improves their academic, improves their test scores, and improves their school experience. And I think that there's a lot of kids, you know, they didn't, it's not the kids' fault they live in Pleasant Hill at all. And Pleasant Hill has a like, I think 1040 around that for Norman, and they have a little more than 300. So the 1,400 kids that live in the area, the kind of that I serve as a family support worker, I see lots of those kids who don't have adequate nutrition at home and they're not getting it at school. And as expenses go up, as gasoline costs more, there's even less money for food. And even if mom gets a food box, that's only twice a month at the local food bank, and it's just not adequate. So we know that it helps their academic performance. Just one other note, I spoke with a woman who works in our resource room. Actually, this was a year ago when she worked there. 9 first graders coming in for reading in the resource room. Only one of them had breakfast. And so Susan and I tried to scrounge up some food. We'd get some things from Fifth and Lane County or others to try to give the kids some yogurt or whatever we could scrounge up for them, because it really did affect their academic performance. But also affects their behavior. Lower school district, I spoke with Pam Miller, who's a principal there, and they started a pilot program this year where they serve the kids juice and toast. And that's not that nutritious, it's not in a protein or anything, but he said that there was a dramatic increase in the, a dramatic decrease in the number of behaviors, dysphoria he had. Program behavior was so much better, even with just juice and toast in the morning. So, you know, we know that it affects their learning, it affects their behavior, it also affects their attendance. We have a half-day kindergarten in Pleasant Hill. We have Monday, Wednesday, every other Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, every other Friday. We had a little boy moved up with mom. She was living in a communal situation, you know, several families together. He was only coming to kindergarten on Wednesday. The office called after a few weeks. He was not coming on Monday and Friday because there was no food, and mom had no food. She couldn't make him a lunch, so she just didn't send him. It's an economic burden on families that live in our district. And I know it's an economic burden for the district to think about, you know, having the staff to have to pay for someone to do all the paperwork, to have to think about that in the kitchen. But it's also, it's a bigger burden on the families that live in our district. because a lot of families that have moved out of Pleasant Hill and Yale school districts because it's just the straw that pushes them over the edge. They can't deal with that. And so I think it would improve the nutrition, improve the quality of what we're serving the kids, and it would help them academically, it would help the attendance. I mean, to me, it's just been kind of Pleasant Hill's dirty little secret that we haven't had a hot lunch program all these years, and we have a lot of other things that are very commendable. And I just, I am wholeheartedly in favor of this bill.
Well, thank you very much. Question with the lady. I have a question, because I want to go back to state that it isn't necessary for them to have kitchen facilities. I mean, that would be ideal if they did have and they could provide the lunch. But I just wanted to ask you, currently, at the schools that aren't serving lunch, do they have supervision during the lunch hour? With classified employees, like, I mean, are the children being supervised during the time?
They have a lunch time.
Yeah, and do they have classified employees that are supervising the kids while they're eating lunch?
Yes.
Or not eating lunch?
Yes.
So, in effect, those same classified employees that are supervising the kids could possibly also distribute a packaged lunch and milk. And so really then that is a minimal fiscal impact on the school. They would need to have someone who could keep track of the kids that qualified for the lunches and what the reimbursement was, the paperwork.
Correct.
But I assume that then they also have a financial manager that is employed by the district.
They do, but that would be an extra burden. It takes quite a bit of time to do those records, as I understand.
It is somewhat time-consuming, but since all of the other school districts in Oregon managed to do it just fine, I think that it's probably a job that is doable.
It could be, right. But it is a concern for the district.
Yes, and thank you for expressing that concern. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. We will now close the public hearing on House Bill 3151, and we will move to a public hearing on House Bill 3168. And Mr. Keller, if you would give us a brief.
House Bill 3168 revises special education law to address amendments to Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2005, and does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. I have Nancy Latini.
Good afternoon, Chair Flores, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Latini, the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. In December of 2004, President Bush signed into law the reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. Federal regulations to clarify this law will not be in effect and not be published until the end of this year. Some of the provisions in the law, that those requiring highly qualified special education teachers, for example, is effective immediately. The rest of the compliance is expected by July 1 of this year. House Bill 3168 proposes to amend some of the statutory language in the Oregon statutes regarding special education so that it is aligned with the reauthorization. The statutes will need to be in place by the time full compliance is expected in July 1 of 2005. There aren't any huge changes to the Oregon statutes. There are, however, enough changes that we do have to make them in order to be in full compliance so that we can secure the IDEA funds that come to us on an annual basis. The department staff worked quickly to analyze the law and analyze the statutes and align them, and I thank Mr. Keller for leading us in the right way of getting that done quickly. These changes then would put us into full compliance with the new federal law. We don't anticipate any fiscal burden. What we would be doing is using our discretionary IDEA funds to conduct the training to the field staff, which we would be using for other kinds of training for the year anyway. But we would focus more on the new law and helping to implement that. I thank you for considering this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. There is a chart attached of all the statutory changes. You'll notice that most of them are adding to current statutes. There really isn't a new one or changing a little bit of the language. And we haven't talked about any of them. If there are any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from Ms. McKee? Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one that kind of caught my eye is a word of the state. It was my understanding that children in foster care in Oregon are considered goods in the state. Is that incorrect?
Some of them are and some of them aren't. What they're trying to do is attend to two things. One are the homeless children and one are wards of the state, and making sure that we attend to their needs as well. They're an overlooked set of population nationwide.
Thank you.
Representative Redmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We work these out, and then do we send them to IDEA, the federal, to say, did we meet that you're expecting, or do we just take it for, we just hope that we have met all those requirements?
Chair, some members of the committee represented the river. That's a very good question. Actually, we just submitted our annual performance review for this year to the federal government yesterday, and so in a year they will be asking for all of this and to prove that we are in alignment. So we know because we meet only every other year, we needed to get this in right now. We couldn't wait. Some states may be waiting until when we have an annual legislative session. And so ours will be in place, hopefully by then too, our regulations will be in place.
Bringing Oregon into compliance with what is already in place at the federal level.
Right, that's what I am, yeah. And that's how it goes. And I get concerned because, we aren't going to meet next year. And if these don't meet everything that they expect, they're going to send us a note back that says, you're not in compliance in these areas. And how do we deal with that?
Representative Flores, Representative Rowland, I think they do. I mean, we look at them. We have legal staff and our staff to look at them. Actually, because our statutes are so clear, it was really nice to go through them with, and we were doing line by line with the law to make sure that we did that. If not, what they would do is put us, I understand, they would put us into some kind of a conditional approval until we got it done, and we would have to say we need every other year, so our condition will have to last that long. And I would hope that they would, we haven't ever been there, so I don't expect us to get there.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I have been remiss in announcing that we do have live captioning today for persons who are deaf or hard of hearing and have American Sign Language interpreters for anyone so requesting one. I apologize for the delay in doing that. Thank you, Ms. McKinney. Bob Jendal.
I'm sure members of the committee. My name is Bob June Deaf. I'm from the Oregon Advocacy Center.
I'm so sorry.
June like the month and deaf like you have a hearing impairment.
Sorry.
And you might need the services to my left.
Thank you.
I'm here just to deliver a simple message, and that is that, of course, our office provides advocacy to children and their families in special education matters. Our attorneys reviewed the bill before you, found that, at least in our opinion, it is in compliance with changes in the federal law, which is the good news and the bad news from our perspective, because from our perspective, the federal law has eliminated many vital protections for children with disabilities, and we're concerned about that. And so the message that I was asked to convey to you today is that, yes, the changes have been made on the federal level. Oregon has had a continuing policy of not exceeding the requirements of the federal law, and that has not been the policy of every state in the union. Many states have taken it upon themselves to provide greater services and greater protections for children with disabilities. We wish Oregon was among those states. Oregon is not. And so I just wanted to convey the message to you that as we move ahead, hopefully this committee may consider the thought that, in fact, the federal law is a floor and not a ceiling in terms of services provided for children with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Jindak?
Thank you
for your comments and duly noted. Well, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3168 and open a work session on House Bill 68. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3168 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. To the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Can we go to four?
Yes,
we have a couple of members who are not with us today.
Representative March has moved House Bill 3168 to the floor with a DPAS recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Anybody else speak, please?
No. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. Having obtained the majority, this House Bill 3168 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We will close the public work session. We move now to House Bill 3154. Mr. Kelly, please.
House Bill 3154 requires State Board of Higher Education to study and make recommendations on standards of behavior for tenured faculty at state institutions of higher education. And it does not have a referral.
Okay. Can you just step down? Yes, I do. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda Flores. I'm State Representative for House District 51. This bill is brought before the committee primarily because of some concerns that were expressed to me, and I brought this bill forward at the request of a constituent. And the concerns that were expressed were as a result of some of the more recent public issues from faculty at institutions of higher education. So it was the intent of this particular bill to at least bring to the debate that there are individuals and citizens who are very concerned about the comportment, I guess we might say, of our instructors and professors in institutions of higher learning. And realizing that there are all kinds of issues regarding First Amendment freedoms of speech and what have you, that was not the issue, that there is a freedom of speech issue, but perhaps the content of that speech and therefore the instruction. Very simply, that is what is before you today.
Any questions from the room?
And I'm sure that you do, Mr.
I do. Was your constituent concerned about a particular situation in Oregon, or was it elsewhere?
It was not a situation in Oregon, and as a matter of fact, it was a Colorado situation.
Colorado. Okay.
In order just to let the statement be made that perhaps we should be watching.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Any other questions then? All right.
Thank you very much.
And the, let's see, Benjamin Rollins. And the chair is now back.
Good afternoon. Chairman Flores, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Rollins, and I'm General Counsel for the Oregon University System. I'm here to speak on behalf of the system in terms of sharing concerns with the committee and essentially providing background information for your review of this area of concern. The State Board of Higher Ed and the Oregon University System currently engage in multiple areas in which the conduct and behavior, looking at the language in 3154, of faculty, including tenured faculty, is indeed regulated and kept within reasonable standards. Now, this level of concern, as expressed by the State Board, exists via their administrative rules. Campuses within the Oregon University System are then free to promulgate other regulations consistent with this umbrella authorization as provided by the State Board. So the primary concern is to let you know that there are currently areas of regulation and rules that address appropriate decorum, appropriate comportment. Examples of this would be in the OAR's Administrative Rules, Divisions 20, 21, and 22. Further examples, in OAR 580-021-325, this is the regulation that reserves the prerogative to the state board and to the institution to terminate a faculty member for cause, which would include the authority to terminate a tenured faculty member for cause. So, examples of that might be conviction of a felony, conviction of a crime involving moral turpitude, or failure to perform responsibilities, including responsibilities to colleagues or to students. Further examples could also get into the academic area of gross incompetence or default of responsibility or failure to carry out their duties to the university. Other areas of regulation would include 580-022-0045, which there talks about areas of proscribed conduct. This rule applies to any individual but can also apply to members of the faculty, so that the authorization exists to regulate obstruction of teaching, obstruction of academic activities, disruption of academic freedom, disruption of academic pursuits, possessions of weapons, malicious damage to property, etc. Further examples would also include the conflict of interest regulation, again in Division 210025, which would regulate an individual's ability to engage in research, multiple employment, to make sure that the loyalty owed to the university is paramount in terms of their activities. Again, the ability to regulate this behavior. From these broad regulations, the campuses then are able to promulgate other rules, which will get into things such as regulations and policies on sexual harassment, regulations and policies on consensual relations. I might note that another area that is regulated is the reservation and respect for academic freedom. While it is noted that faculty members have the freedom to express themselves pursuant to their academic beliefs, they are reminded that there are reasonable limits on this. And this is also a regulation which exists within the OERs as well as the IMDs, which are interagency management directives. My intent today is to describe for you a well-conceived, purposeful effort to try to identify areas of acceptable behavior for faculty and even those who enjoy tenure, and then allow the institutions within the concepts of shared governance, working with their faculties, to further regulate the individual behavior. So I wanted to be on record before you to let you know that the institutions of the Oregon University system do in fact take the responsibility serious and have regulations that would establish permissible parameters such that faculty members would have a reasonable understanding of what is expected of them as representatives of the institution and of the state. My purpose was that, and I'll be happy to respond to any questions that you, Madam Chair, or any members of the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Rollins, Representative Mark?
Mr. Rollins, for example, if professor went sort of beyond the reasonable limits of academic freedom, would a process on the campus be something like they might appear before the academic senate or faculty senate and be called to explain their actions?
Chairman March, while this procedures will vary, the most likely one is to receive a notification by the faculty member's supervisor, which would then engender some degree of discussion. It is possible that a faculty member could be called to a higher body, so to speak, but it is thought to the effort is initiated at the lowest level of communication first.
So it's at the department it works up.
Correct, sir.
Thank you.
somewhat of a follow-up with that in an academic freedom context, and the aside from the board and administrative roles and the internal regulations, then within the context of academic freedom, does that extend to what would define inflammatory speech?
Chairman, the regulations have not evolved to that degree of specificity. They've been approached on a case-by-case basis. In fact, out of respect for the fact that the faculty's subject matter is such a wide range, and literally goes from A to Z, soup to nuts, any comparison you can think of, such that it is then looked at on an individual basis as to what may go beyond the bounds. No, they have not tried to define that ahead of time, primarily for those limitations.
Okay. And are there internal regulations in addition to organ administrative rules that might address such concerns as plagiarism of prior work and or misrepresentation of credentials?
Oh, absolutely. There are regulations with all of the institutions regarding the responsibility of accuracy in your research. When involved plagiarisms, these regulations would exist for the students as well as the faculty, I might add. Additionally, the federal government has promulgated its concerns in terms of scientific reporting, and there are specific committees on scientific misconduct which have jurisdiction over those somewhat more specific areas. So yes, it is regulated, and yes, faculty members are told clearly that is beyond acceptability.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Redmond.
Along that same, I guess, a little different tack, but consensual relationships between a faculty member and a student are also things that individuals, schools can regulate?
Yes, sir. That is correct. In fact, they can and do regulate, sir.
Representative Shear.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping I could just maybe make a comment about this, just so that everybody knows kind of the background, I presume, of what happened in Colorado. There was a professor there, Ward Churchill, that has become under a lot of pressure for speech that a lot of people didn't agree with. And I think it's important just to clarify for those here that it was I assume that that's the issue that's driving this. And it seems to me that the intent is to constrict speech, in my view, and so on that basis, I would think that we would want to show a lot of caution if we move forward with this.
Thank you, Representative Shields, for your comments, and I think that I did indicate that there was no specific intent to restrict speech, because I think that we're all in concurrence about the provisions of our First Amendment freedoms, primarily to be a prison and safeguard for abuse of position. Thank you very much, Ms. Long, for your testimony today. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3154. We will open House Bill 2967. As a subcommittee, I'm pleased to be not until we have someone returning here.
House Bill 2967 requires publisher of instructional materials for post-secondary students upon request from post-secondary education institution to provide materials in electronic format to institutions for use by students with disabilities for educational purposes. Specifies that failure of publishers to provide materials in electronic format is unlawful practice of a discrimination, allows civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 for each violation, allows civil cause of action. And there is a subsequent referral to the judiciary.
Okay, I'd like to call David McDonald, please.
For the record, my name is David McDonald. I'm Director of Enrollment and Student Services for the Oregon University System. First of all, I'd like to thank the sponsors of this bill for their efforts to increase the availability of course material that is for students who need additional visual support services. Proposals such as this are important in our overall efforts to support the learning and success of all students. As a reminder, the State Board of Higher Education has made significant progress in developing policies and practices that address the four priority areas, which include access to a college degree, affordability of a college education, excellence in teaching and research, and economic development for the entire state. House Bill 2967 clearly is focused upon our access priority. As I indicated before, the goals of this bill are to be applauded. However, at this time, there is a need for additional conversations within the Oregon University system and its campuses to further examine and discuss the potential impacts and implementation of this bill. We respectfully request an opportunity to have those discussions before any action is taken on this bill. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address this committee on this important issue. We welcome the opportunity to work with the Oregon Advocacy Center and others on the issues of student access and success. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. McDonald?
Mr. McDonald, what kind of potential impacts do you foresee with this bill? It's mostly targeted at the publisher, so what do you see as a potential problem at the academic level?
Chair Flores, Vice Chair March, our major concern is that publishers will not be able to provide material in the format required by the bill, and hence faculty will have fewer options in terms of course material available to students and have a negative impact on learning. We need further time to really look at the depth of that potential problem.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like to call up Naomi Dingle, Bob Jindep, and is it Ted Wink?
Chair Flores and members of the committee, I'm Naomi Dingle from the University of Portland. I'd like to request permission from my colleague, Clark Hoxettler from Portland Community College, to join me as well.
Okay, certainly. Perhaps I'll have the other two panels.
I'm Naomi Dingle, coordinator of the Office for Students with Disabilities at the University of Portland. And the University of Portland supports House Bill 2967 because the university believes that it will make learning materials more accessible to students with disabilities provided by colleges and universities. It would be more cost-effective for colleges and universities. For example, the University of Portland in the academic year 2003-2004 spent $1,890 converting 29 books that we were not able to receive from publishers in an accessible format for 15 students with disabilities. In 2004-2005, to date, the university has spent over $1,500 converting 26 books for 16 students with disabilities. These are costs that could be utilized in other ways. We're also a small university. We have 3,300 students, and we have 66 students with disabilities registered with our office. So you can see that the magnitude for larger universities would be increased. It would...
I would like to call up Naomi Dingle, Bob Jindep, and Ted Wink.
Chair Flores and members of the committee, I'm Naomi Dingle from the University of Portland. I'd like to request permission from my colleague, Clark Hoxettler from Portland Community College, to join me as well.
Okay, certainly. Perhaps I'll have the other two panelists.
I'm Naomi Dingle, coordinator of the Office for Students with Disabilities at the University of Portland. And the University of Portland supports House Bill 2967 because the university believes that it will make learning materials more accessible to students with disabilities provided by colleges and universities. it would be more cost-effective for colleges and universities. For example, the University of Portland in the academic year 2003-2004 spent $1,890 converting 29 books that we were not able to receive from publishers in an accessible format for 15 students with disabilities. In 2004-2005, to date, the university has spent over $1,500 converting 26 books for 16 students with disabilities. These are costs that could be utilized in other ways. We're also a small university. We have 3,300 students, and we have 66 students with disabilities registered with our office. So you can see that the magnitude for larger universities would be increased. It would provide more effective access for students and also for universities. One electronic file from a publisher could be used for a Braille format, could be used for enlarged print, and could be used for speech synthesis. So that one file could be used for a number of different students with different needs based upon their disability type. Also, electronic text is more effective and efficient for students to use, so they can use their time learning rather than searching for information. Also, many publishers are looking to the future already and have been making electronic text available since many states have passed similar legislation to this bill. Those states include California, Washington, New York, Nevada, New Mexico, Georgia, Arkansas, and Kentucky. Currently colleges may be duplicating efforts. We may have the same book required for a course, and two different colleges may be converting that book into electronic text. This bill would eliminate that duplication of effort. We also, at the university, have a process for ensuring that the copyright of that material is protected and students must sign a copyright agreement. We also ensure compliance with publishers when publishers have specific copyright requirements. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Fox. That was first.
Yes. I'd like to read my statement that you have. Chair Flores and committee. I support the bill being presented here today. I've been involved with the provision of disability services at Portland Community College for close to 30 years. During this time, I've witnessed a dramatic growth in the numbers of students with disabilities who aspire to advanced academic training. Their efforts and achievements have been an inspiration to me personally and have added richness and diversity to the fabric of our community. The technology has provided us with unique opportunities to level the playing field for students with disabilities. As a tool, technology opens up resources and materials to thousands of students who learn differently or who have sensory limitations. This technology aside, the printed word is still the main method of transmitting information and will continue to be. As you know, it is the printed word and the right of students to have that word made available to them in a manner that they can utilize that brings us here today. The ADA and Section 504 of the Rehab Act of 1973 clearly state that students who experience disability have a right to accessible educational materials. Colleges and universities around the country struggle to make these materials available for students in a timely manner. What we find to be most frustrating is that these materials are in accessible formats prior to being put into print, and that we then must spend hundreds of hours annually converting these materials back into the accessible format that our students need. This term, spring 2005, our institution has 51 requests for textbooks to be modified. Today, at the end of the term's first week, we have received just 6 books in electronic format from publishers. And I have been informed that one of those 6 successes has major portions of the text missing, so we will be converting the rest of it ourselves. We are working diligently to convert the other materials in-house on an installment basis to stay ahead of the student needs. This is an expensive and sometimes overwhelming task for our institution and resources. Clearly, the advantage of being able to access publishers' electronic media is that it is already available and we do not need to convert it. The cost to convert this material averages around $200 per standard textbook at our institution.
textbooks that have them, that have special formatting, technical jargon, or other mathematical symbols can cost hundreds more due to the proofing and editing that must be done. At issue for us is 1, publisher compliance to our requests, and 2, timeliness of their response. We are hopeful that the legislation being considered will assist colleges and universities in Oregon to meet their educational needs of students who experience print-related disabilities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have questions for this panel? You can read today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Bob Jindal from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and I'm proud to bring this bill before you today because this is a bill that really is designed to give people an equal playing field in terms of going to college, becoming productive citizens, people who are working hard to achieve and experience some impediments to achievement that have nothing to do with themselves, their character, or their desire to succeed in our state. This really just is, gives them an opportunity to be productive citizens and to succeed. I'd like to address 2 points, and then I'll hand it over to Mr. Ted Rank, who's an attorney in our office who works on these issues. 2 concerns, or 3 concerns actually have been raised, and I just want to address quickly. And 1 has to do with what the impact would be of requiring publishers to provide textbooks in this format. I'd respond to that by saying that right now, today, New York, Texas, and California have similar bills. I can tell you, if you add up the number of textbooks that sell into those states and compare them to what might come into Oregon, I think there'll be a full array of textbooks that are available to the citizens of Oregon because we are, with no disrespect to our fair state, a very small player amongst those giants. Secondly, as was noted earlier, textbooks start in electronic formats in today's technology, and so we're really talking about making something available that exists already rather than a manufacturer having to prepare it. And this bill has been drawn very narrowly to make sure that copyright protections are in place and that additional burdens, should they exist, are exempted. So we really try to be sensitive to those issues. Another issue that you will hear a little bit later in the testimony today is that nationally there's an effort to address this issue in Congress. In response to that, and that this, the state of Oregon should wait for Congress to act. All I can say is that I called my national office. We do have a national support office that engages in advocacy at the national level, and I asked them about this, and the person laughed and said, you're going to wait a long time for this to happen at a national level. You know, if you can do it at the state level, you should, and so I will convey that message to you. Mr. Chair, now in terms of the details of the bill, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Ted Rank from our office.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how much I can add to what was said here, but as was pointed out by the University of Poland Disability Services Coordinator and Mr. Hutzler from PCC, and I believe there was some other testimony that was coming in. Colleges and universities already provide the service, so there are systems in place right now regarding which students are eligible and when they must be provided. Basically, the bill would say that the student must have a disability, they go to the disability services office at their institution, they are enrolled in the class, so they need the textbook for that class. The disabilities office then requests that they obtain the textbook, they pay for the textbook, the copyright is protected, and hopefully the student then get the textbook on time. And you'll hear from some students and some other people here today that it has been a problem for them. If it's a big strain on the Disability Services Office to provide this, and it's particularly frustrating for them, I imagine, that they're converting, sending a tremendous amount of resources, converting something back into, oftentimes into a format that was, that the publisher has. The student does have to, you know, pay for their copy of the textbook. One other thing that really came up nationally was, under the IDEA, there was a format, recognized, in the recent reauthorization for K-12, this legislation references that format. So I think we're on the right track here, really. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Green?
Thank you. You've got California, New York, and Texas. Those are the big three. Have you had any contacts with the publishers themselves and to kind of say, hey, this is no brainer, why don't you just provide it?
I'm Chair Representative March. The one contact that we've had directly with the publishers is Mr. Gardner will bring to you today, which is just their concern that they handle it on a national level, but that's the only interaction we've had. We stand ready to work with them and any other party that has concerns about the bill to try to work out something, but thus far that's the only feedback we've had from the industry.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'd like to call Mark Zoltan, is it? You can correct me once you're forward. And Jim Gardner, please. You can set it over into the table.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Zoltan. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I've submitted written testimony on behalf of Commissioner Gardner, and I'll just make some brief comments in addition to that. First of all, we'd like to applaud the efforts of the Oregon Advocacy Center bringing this issue forward, and we look forward to working with them on some of the concerns I'm going to outline briefly for you now. One of those was just addressed in the testimony just before me regarding we, up until this point, are unclear what the coordination is, if any, between what's happening on the congressional level and the timing of this state legislation. We know there's been efforts in both the House and the Senate in Washington where they've passed bills but have failed to reconcile them about setting these parameters and standards, and that eventually we will have to have a state law to reflect those, but we were unclear and remain a little unclear about where that process is on the federal level. Secondly, we just wanted to point out that as written, HB 2967 does include a go-to-court or judicial remedy that would allow an individual suing to enforce its provisions and receive compensatory and punitive damages, as well as a jury trial. We had some questions regarding who exactly would be suing whom under this legislation. The Legislative Council's office has clarified some of those and has told us earlier today that individuals would be allowed to sue, they would only be allowed to sue the publisher of the materials as opposed to the educational institution. So that's helpful to know that information. And finally, and most importantly, I guess our greatest concern involves something you hear a lot about this session, which is our budgetary situation at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. If the proponents of this legislation expect us to investigate these matters administratively, we face a tough challenge in that we've undergone a 33% cut in our civil rights division over the last decade and do not have the financial wherewithal to take on new mandates without further resources or staff. And Commissioner Gardner, while supportive of the intent of this legislation, feels obligated to point that out, that without additional funding, he's not sure how we would be able to investigate these matters. And we would respectfully ask the committee to consider the possibility of placing the enforcement responsibility for this measure in another agency with more existing staff capacity or non-general fund resources, given the current budget situation at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I thank you for your time, and we'll answer any questions.
we can insert an apology here. We four of the bug.
We all ask a question while you're recovering. I missed the section where you're the investigator. You point that out to me.
Chair Flores, Representative March, on the last section of the bill, Section 5, it talks about a publisher shall be considered a place of public accommodation for the purposes of RS 659.
Okay.
9A.4. Oh, well, those are our magic.
That's your number. Okay. Thank you. That clears it up. I didn't see the word in there. And I know we wouldn't want to just increase your powers by exponential amounts.
No. Any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Bradley.
You've got me to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I am here today on behalf of the Association of American Publishers, and specifically the division of that association, which represents manufacturers, publishers of college-level texts. And I want to begin by saying that in another capacity, I've had the privilege of working with Bob Jindeff. He's an extraordinary individual, extraordinary advocate, and has just done wonderful things for the state of Oregon, continues to do them. So it is with some reluctance that I must appear in opposition to House Bill 2967. I want to also note that AAP does appreciate the intent of House Bill 2967, and that publishers are working every day to better serve students with special needs. We do not, however, feel that this legislation will advance that goal in a material way. And for background, let me point out that publishers played a leading role in this year's passage of the federal legislation that provides uniform standards for the production and distribution of K through 12 textbooks in an electronic format called NIMAS, National Instructional Materials Accessibility Standard. House Bill 2967 is really an attempt to transpose into the K through 12 textbook world that requirement and apply it to college textbooks. The many differences between the K through 12 and the college sectors make this effort, we think, impractical and potentially self-defeating. First, it's important to recognize that K through 12 textbooks are generally adopted on a massive scale by entire states or school districts. In these instances, K through 12 publishers know well in advance what special requirements they will have to meet and can plan and budget accordingly. By contrast, college textbooks are generally ordered by individual professors for individual classes, and in many instances, particularly in specialized topics, the orders are for very small numbers of textbooks or other items like a research report, a white paper, or an obscure, out-of-date book. The NIMAS format required as a default, absent the party's agreement, by House Bill 2967 is in fact expensive to produce, sometimes costing tens of thousands of dollars for a single textbook. The cost of meeting that standard would, in many instances, force publishers to increase the price for their materials. And in some cases, and this is what is truly worrisome, and it was the concern that was brought to you by the Oregon University System spokesman who preceded me, in some instances, because of the onerous fine structure in this bill, publishers would have no alternative but to remove the books and other materials from college bookstores and, in effect, make them unavailable in Oregon, denying Oregon students access to the best education. And this legislature and the governor have frequently articulated the policy goal of increasing the quality of higher education in Oregon. And if what I just discussed were to occur, I think that would be a step backward. From a purely practical perspective, you should be aware that Oregon's Disabled Student Services rarely request, at least up to this time, materials in the NIMAS format. The reason is simple. Neither they nor the students they serve have the equipment, generally, to use these kinds of electronic files. They may have these capabilities someday, but they generally do not have them now. For now, many publishers are already providing the PDF, Microsoft, and ASCII files that are being requested. Not in every instance, but in many instances they are. Now, in addition to those concerns, I want to note that House Bill 2967 takes a giant leap into some novel legal territory, both state and federal. And here is where I have not read personally the New York, the California, or the Texas legislation, but I would be very surprised if it contained anything like Section 5. Section 5 states that a publisher shall be considered a place of public accommodation. That's a very long stretch. And if one accepts that interpretation of the law, or that extension of the law, then one would have to accept the proposition that that same principle ought to apply to every product consumed in this state. The legal wrangling that particular provision in the bill would set off, I can assure you, would lead to long, complex, and expensive litigation, expensive for all concerned. Allow me to make one final point. And I want to, I guess, disagree with Bob Jundeff on this a little bit. I want you to be aware that the Association of American Publishers and its members are working now with advocates for the disabled to develop federal legislation that will meet the goals addressed in House Bill 2967. There was a successful effort that I alluded to at the beginning of my testimony in the K-12 area. They're working now on federal standards at the higher education level. I can tell you that the executive director of the Publishers Association met just last week in Washington with the staff of Wyoming United States Senator Michael Enzi, who is chair of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, to advise them of AAP's plans to introduce this legislation. And a meeting is being held at AAP's Washington offices on April 21st with advocates and publishers' representatives to discuss and negotiate the form and content of this legislation. So this is on anything but a slow bell. We're very serious about approaching this issue at the federal level. And we think that approach, not a patchwork quilt of state legislation that might have, as the representative of the Oregon University System mentioned, might have deleterious effect on our own higher education system and its quality, the national approach is what does make sense. And we would urge you to remain interested in this issue, remain supportive of federal legislation, but not move this bill.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Gardner,
thank you much. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. One, I'd like to get a copy of the proposal coming at the federal level. Two, I'm a little chagrined that it takes so much effort to get electronic copies from several of your members. I'm sure several are very cooperative in that, while others are not. It does start out in electronic form, so it's not like recreating the world there. But my question is, do you think having a few bills like this, perhaps with an effective date of 2007, so an effective date of 2008 would add a little heat to make sure that the publishers do move forward.
Mr. Chair, I can assure you that the introduction and pendency of bills like this has certainly focused their attention on the value and need of moving expeditiously at the federal level. I can also assure you that there is a strong, genuine commitment to following the example that we in effect with the advocates for the disabled set in the K-12 format in doing that at the federal level in an effective way. I think that what I would advocate is that this committee become, and we'd be delighted to help in this effort, become fully aware of what the federal proposal looks like, and I'll be delighted to get that to you of its of the push that's behind it, but defer action of the sort that that you mentioned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. If you would make that information available to Mr. Keller, Representative Rowland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know in these other states that have, if they have chosen the same formats to keep put in their bills requesting information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rowland, that's one of the things I'm going to find out. I do not now know what. I think it's most common, as I mentioned, that they are requested and transmitted in Microsoft Word, a good format, in PDF or in ASCII. I think those are the three most common ways they're requested and provided. I'll check on that for you.
Additional questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you. I'd like to call Michael Levine, Nathan Jimenez. There was no Z on me. And Celine Brown. As you would desire.
I'm Nathan Jimenez, former assistant district leader for District 36 for the Democratic Party, also former chair of the delegation of the 1st Congressional District Committee, and current chair of Talk to Me and Family Citizen Awareness PAC Committee 4626. It's a political action committee of fundraisers for the purpose of purchasing political advertising, and also a visually impaired person who, even though I have glasses and contacts at times, I still don't have full corrective vision. And also someone who is studying for his Series 7, the stockbroker's licensing exam. As legislators, you face the challenges of government. You face the daunting task time and again to carry out the need to legislate the solutions to the social ills of our time, while at the same time ensuring that indeed social responsibilities are met and the Pax Americana is achieved in our day. As John Kennedy said, how can you save the rich if you can't help the poor? You must make sure the government works to build our state, to encourage commerce, to educate our people, and to promote equal opportunity, to advance science, to support the arts and humanities, and in order that we all are able to reach difficult and vital goals. We recognize that the capacity of government is limited, but we regard government as a force for good and a source of hope. In all of our hearts lies a fundamental conviction that Americans must not only be free, but they must live in a fair society. We believe it is the responsibility of government to help us achieve this fair society, a society where the disabled, the physically and mentally vulnerable people, can lead lives of dignity, and where collegiate education is an opportunity attainable based upon merit. For this to be achieved, the act of the opportunity for mental illumination must be extended. The opportunity to learn must be provided. This, of course, can be done by providing textbooks for people with physical and mental vulnerabilities or disabilities. Specifically, in this case, in regards to this bill before the legislature, for the this is about people with who are visually impaired and, of course, other people that are touched by disabilities, physical vulnerabilities. Textbooks for people who are visually impaired are essential to ensure that visually impaired people can accomplish the goal of attaining college education. By doing this, people with disabilities, visually impaired people, can get a college education, can find jobs in a growing full employment economy, and have decent wages and conditions of employment. This will allow for a society where equal rights for visually impaired people are a guarantee. where the civil rights of visually impaired minorities are fully secured and where no one is denied the opportunity for a better life. A society where both public and private discrimination based upon physical disabilities, physical and mental vulnerabilities, are condemned, and where a government moves aggressively to end such discrimination through lawful means. A society where we recognize that strengthening but sound education are possible for every citizen, and where our livelihoods are, as visually impaired people, are as stable as the values we instill in the American character. Where the promoting of the sentient rights is our purpose and our promise. We're seeing in our economy here in Oregon that a diversified economy where we have business, finance, biotech, computer, and telecommunication jobs. Now, to be able to make a decent livable wage, one must get educated in those areas. And we see in the corporate world that we're moving toward people with physical and mental vulnerabilities or disabilities. Specifically, in this case, in regards to this bill before the legislature, for the this is about people who are visually impaired and, of course, other people that are touched by disabilities or physical vulnerabilities. Textbooks for people who are visually impaired are essential to ensure that visually impaired people can accomplish the goal of attaining college education. By doing this, people with disabilities, visually impaired people, can get a college education, can find jobs in a growing full employment economy, and have decent wages and conditions of employment. This will allow for a society where equal rights for visually impaired people are a guarantee. But the civil rights of visually impaired minorities are fully secured and where no one is denied the opportunity for a better life. A society where both public and private discrimination based upon physical disabilities, physical and mental vulnerabilities, are condemned, and where a government moves aggressively to end such discrimination through lawful means. A society where we recognize that strengthening but sound education are possible for every citizen, and our livelihoods are, as visually impaired people, are as stable as the values we instill in the American character. Where the promoting of the sentient rights is our purpose and our promise. We're seeing in our economy here in Oregon that a diversified economy where we have business, finance, biotech, computer, and telecommunication jobs. Now, to be able to make a decent livable wage, one must get educated in those areas. And we see in the corporate world that we're moving towards the development of those products and the making of those components for those products, where, of course, the political economic reality is that those components of the development and research to make products are done in this country, but the assembly of those products are done in other countries. Visually impaired people have extremely high sensory organs. So as a result, we are able to do those jobs. And if not in this country, then of course visually impaired people in other countries. It is essential for education that people receive this opportunity to have textbooks, which of course are already in electronic form, and it doesn't take very much to convert it. I'm studying for my Series 7. I have an 800-page textbook and two workbooks. And the entire course is also on CD. We have programs like JAWS and Zoom Text that reads it to us. And we have a Zoom Text that expands and makes the print larger. So it's vital that we have that opportunity, so that we can achieve a fair society and that we can have a decent livable life. So thank you for your time and allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Jimenez. Good afternoon. Is this thing on?
It is on.
Okay. My name is Celine Brown, and I am a student, a senior at Portland State University. I am also the coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Cultural Association on Portland State's campus and president of the Diversity Chapter of the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. and I'm coming here today mostly as a student. I've worked a lot with advocating and empowering people to advocate for themselves regarding textbooks, but I just wanted to give you a perspective of a student that has actually scanned her books every single term. Terms are 11 weeks long. Currently, I'm taking 8 credit hours, which is 2 classes. I have 4 textbooks between those 2 classes. A textbook usually contains anywhere between 9 and 16 chapters, between 20 and 30 pages per chapter. So it would take me approximately roughly 20 minutes, maybe a little bit more, if the chapter is 30 pages. So if you have a 16-chapter textbook, that's a lot of time. I was trying to figure it out last night. It was like over 3 hours or something like that. And I was just thinking, 3 hours, wow, if I had that much time, if my book was already e-text, and I had that 3 hours to work on a paper or read the chapter or, read several chapters from all of each book, that would be great. I would love it. Right now, I know that as working part-time and also being a full-time student, I use the DSS office, the Disability Student Services, located at Portland State, and I know that when I submitted my 4 textbooks to them this term, the first question they asked me was, do you know of any publishers that are going to have, you know, this book available to you? Do you know of anything? Right off the bat, and I was like, no, I don't know of anyone, but, you know, we can check it out. And that was the first thing they did, was they checked to see if any of these books are e-text already, and none of them were. The reason why none of them were e-text, mostly, actually, I don't know why they weren't e-text, the other part of it is that there's other organizations, like Talking Book and Braille Services, which usually doesn't have college textbooks, but sometimes they will, and then Recordings for the Blind and Dyslexic. The problem with these two places, RFB&D and TDABS, is that they don't have current things, current books. So most textbooks are 2004, 2005 copyright. And if the publishers would give them to us via e-text, then, you know, we wouldn't have to be putting them onto cassette tape. So when, you know, I called the bookstore over spring break and found out what my copyright dates were, one of them was 1992, and I was so excited. And the reason I was excited is because I knew I could get it on cassette tape rather than having it scanned and taking several hours. So, thank you, and I'll take any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. We'll take our next panelist, and then we'll ask questions at the end.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm going to go at this at a little different angle. I'm not going to probably be as fluent as the speakers you heard today.
Would you give us your name, please?
I'm sorry, my name is Michael Levine.
Thank you.
I gave you a handout. If you all had a chance to look at it or not, and I'm going to share something I'm not proud of. I'm a high school dropout, and I'm a high school dropout because of my visual problems. In the day and age that I went to school, the tools that are available and can be available for students today were not available. I fell through the cracks. People didn't even know what my eye disease was. When I was a youngster, I wasn't even diagnosed until I was 20 years old. I was going to just stick with that part of my testimony today, but hearing people wanting you all to table this, do all kinds of research, looking into who's doing what, does not make any sense to me.
There are others like myself that have not had an education. There are going to be people that will not have an education. Computers aren't anything new. Why wasn't this looked into years and years and years ago? I urge you, to no end, I urge you to pass this. Don't wait for the federal government. People in Oregon, people throughout this whole country, people throughout the world have a right to an education. And different formats for different disabilities should not be on a shelf somewhere waiting for people to investigate. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Let's not go through that again. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Celine, what percentage of the books that you've gotten were already on tape? Can you just, like, ballpark that?
I would say I've been in school for 8 years. Off the top of my head, I would say less than 10. The rest of them I've scanned into the computer myself. And I did that for 6 years, scanning them in. And these last 2 years I've been working, and so have given that to the DSS office to do. And the other part of that, though, is that I'm reluctant to give it to the DSS office, because when my syllabus says that I need to have read chapter 1, 2, and 3, and this is true, it's school things, so chapter 1, 2, and 3 by next Thursday, and they have several other people needing their books scanned as well, and I'm just put on that list, it's possible I'm not going to get chapters 1, 2, and 3 read by next Thursday, which means that I may not be able to fully participate in class. So the other reason why I choose to scan books, which would be a real plus on the e-text, is because when you're listening to a book on tape, stopping and starting the tape recorder over and over again to, you know, get that quote down on the computer, to typing it in your notes on the computer, just takes so much time. Whereas if it's scanned or if it's e-text, all you do is copy and paste. So, and it's great for papers. Just an FYI, just so you know.
Yeah, actually, just one comment, and this is for Michael. I read your prepared remarks here, and you did very well. I give you an A on this one. So, we need some credit here. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Representative March.
Thank you very much. Were there questions?
Madam Chair, I wasn't here during the bulk of the testimony, and I apologize because I was testifying on a bill that I sponsored in another committee. But I have a question for Mr. Gardner regarding the, and what's the terminology, e-text? The availability of it on, is it e-text? Is that what it's called? Availability of it online?
Yeah.
So with the e-text availability or non-availability, I mean, what is the cost to the publisher to provide it?
We're going to have someone.
Madam Chair, Jim Gardner for APP. The default format that's specified in the bill is a particular format called NIMAS, N-I-M-A-S, and it is the conversion into that format that I was referring to. That's a format that's can be costly to convert into. When we get requests, which we do, the most frequent type of request is for a file in PDF or ASCII or Word. And those are less costly to provide.
And you are currently providing in this format?
It depends on the publisher, Madam Chair. It's an individual decision by the publisher. One of the things that that I believe the federal legislation will address is a effort to make many of the objectives of this bill, to make a uniform set of standards that would apply to all college textbooks.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Follow up. Well, that seems reasonable, and perhaps all textbooks in all schools should provide the same accessibility to people with disabilities.
You mean in lower level education?
Yeah.
I think that Mr. Gardner did testify that those
are unrated
manuals.
Is that what
Member Gardner said? Yes, there was a. I did mention that the association played a leading role in the passage this year of federal legislation that provides uniform standards for the production and distribution of K-12 textbooks. And in that case, that particular format is appropriate because of the large print runs and volumes.
Mm-hmm.
But these are typically much smaller print runs and can be very, very small depending on the specialization of the field.
And of course, then the cost.
The unit cost
would be more expensive.
And I'm getting ahead of myself because I haven't actually seen the draft of the federal legislation, but it may be that it would specify some other format like PDF or ASCII or Word.
This is for whoever wants to answer, and maybe Celine, you might, since you're the student, might want to answer this. What formats have you found useful for you?
Yes.
Or have you gotten, in other than by tape, have you gotten formats made available to you?
Are you asking through the publishers?
Yeah, or through the school, or through any medium.
Right. Well, what I scan and what the school scanned for me is all put into Word, and then JAWS, which is a screen reader, reads it to me.
Okay.
And it also can be transcribed via the ASCII. I'm learning this is new. Into the Braille display, which is what I'm learning right now. So I'm using both. As far as the PDF goes, that's a little iffy because JAWS is not real friendly with PDF, and you actually have to change some things on your computer in order to make it read the PDF files. So.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, panel. We called Jim Jackson, Kevin O'Reilly, and Molly Cyrillos. Molly. So really, thank you. I would have kept trying until we got there. May proceed in any order you choose.
Hi, my name is Jim Jackson. I'm also a student at Portland State University, and I'm a former coordinator for the Students with Disabilities Union, and current secretary for the National Federation of Blind of Oregon. Recently, the NFB came down to lobby on behalf of the information access for materials, K-12, and I was really, really excited about that. The idea, we had a convention, and they asked how many people in the room have gone to class without having their textbooks. Everybody in the whole room raised their hands, and I was just blown away just how universal this experience was. And there, you know, my experience was I felt isolated. Every time you go into a classroom and, you know, and say, okay, get your books out, and you can't do it, not because you're not eager, you don't, you know, but because the texts aren't being available. It's very uncomfortable, and I would do without it. And I feel like you go and you buy your book, you take it to the DSS office, and there's 10 people ahead of you and you can't get your books until, you know, 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, you know, even if you go to the publishers, right, when they do send it, which is not very often, but I had it once, and they sent it halfway through the term, but, you know, it was like Christmas. I was like, I can do my work. I don't have to rely on other people reading to me, or, you know, this is, you know, an opportunity to give people that equal access that they're all trying to get. I know it doesn't put any strain on teachers at all because they're totally out of the picture. They choose the book and then, you know, it's up to the students to get the book. It's, you know, they don't have any part in that. I use text files. One time I take French classes and they sent them over to France. And the people, I mean, it took a while to get their text, but they sent it in just a plain Unicode text, and I was like, any program can use it. This means if it's the default, I guess that just means if no other format is requested. So if, you know, whatever format the people request, that's the word it should be in. And if it's... I'm in support of this movement. thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin O'Reilly, and I'm here representing the Oregon Disabilities Commission today. And first, I'd like to mention that we feel that as this bill is being implemented, this law is being implemented, the standards that are referenced should be reviewed for adequacy for post-secondary education. We think that's very important. Textbooks are different between the two. As mentioned, some would use prefer Word document as opposed to NIMIS. We do believe that such this rule is in keeping with Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 in providing accessible education. We also feel that most publishers, as I mentioned, would have their textbooks in electronic format, and we didn't think it would be too difficult to convert these texts to a format usable by a text reading software such as JAWS. We understand there would be costs associated with this to the publisher, but we don't think they'd be astronomical and would be harmful and undue hardship, if you will, to the publisher. We believe it's possible to imagine most of these textbooks would arrive in some sort of a CD or a DVD format, and my understanding is that protections could be put on such items to help so copying can't be done too readily, and thus helping protect copyright. We believe obtaining textbooks in electronic format would save our colleges and universities a substantial funds currently used to provide textbooks in Braille on audio tape. My understanding is the U of O has a budget of over $53,000 to do this. And I understand also we spent over 600 hours have been spent converting textbooks to Braille and electronic format. As mentioned earlier, part of the process is to buy a book, cut the pages out, scan them, use another piece of software to read the text, put it into a Word document. The Word document then has to be proofread and edited before being finally handed over to the student. And I understand it's problematic that some of these softwares have a hard time with numbers. You can imagine what that do for an engineering student or a law student, particularly a law student, and have to reference certain sections of the law. We also believe that these textbooks would be delivered more quickly to the student, allowing them to keep up with their coursework, and I guess current testimony kind of reinforces that. And that said, on a personal note, I was rather surprised that publishing companies haven't already done this. It seems like a no-brainer. It's an easy way for them. The books are authored on computers, they're edited on computers, they're prepared for printing on a computer, and they're finally sent to the printer through the computer. Why isn't this being done already? It's, again, a no-brainer.
I
Let me ask very quickly, what does JAWS stand for? What type of
I don't
program?
Know. I
okay.
hear the program exists, and that's about it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was really fun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin, I just thought of this. What is the typical cost of a college textbook?
I imagine, back from my college days. Oh, here we go.
About $68, so. I mean, depending on, that's middle range.
Mm-hmm. But since I have 2 children in college and soon to be 3, I think that the typical cost could be upwards of 100 for some books. Is that
right? Yeah, that's if you get them new, especially. If you get them used, it comes down to maybe $20 or $30. At most.
So you probably know where I'm going with this, so then couldn't the cost be recouped because you're not asking for it to come to you free of charge, you're still paying for the format, you just instead of a hard textbook the way a person that has them on a site can use, you're just asking for an alternative method.
That's what we assumed, yes.
Thank you, Mike, and I just want to thank you to add, we're going to have to ask for an extension of time because we're running down on time.
Talk fast?
Okay.
Yeah, got it. I appreciate it. I recognize you've been here for a long afternoon. So, Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Molly Savoy, and I am I'm from Springfield, Oregon. I'm here to represent the experiences of the students that I've worked with in higher education over the past 7 years. And whom I hope to continue to work with for the rest of my professional life, assuming that my testifying here won't unduly influence that. I am here to vehemently and passionately support House Bill 2967. And so I can get through this really in 2 minutes. I am not knowledgeable about this political process at all. This is my first time testifying. I am not knowledgeable about textbook publishing. But what I am knowledgeable about is the struggle that students encounter trying to access information contained in textbooks and instructional materials that aren't available to them in an accessible format. And I mean a format that just allows any student, regardless of their ability, to access the information that's contained in the printed language. So I just need a moment of your time to consider what abilities are required to read a book. Now, I had a prop and I left it, and I don't want to take your time to get one of those books behind you, so I'd love it. Oh, thank you. So, I'd like you just to take a moment to consider the abilities required to read this book and consider that this is a textbook. First, it requires that you have the ability to pick it up, right, and to place it in front of you. Then, presuming you can do that, it requires the ability to open it and to flip these very thin fraction of a centimeter pages. Then, assuming you can do that, it requires that you have the ability to see the print that's in here, and then the ability to identify the letters, to decode the word, then to track those words across the page, and then assuming you can do all of that, that you possess all those abilities, that then you can comprehend or understand the meaning that is contained therein. I work with students who do not possess all of those abilities. I have worked with students who cannot physically pick up their textbook and place it in front of them because they have quadriplegia or cerebral palsy. I've worked with a student who, in order to flip this page right here, or this, he would have to take off his shoes and turn the pages with his feet, or use his chin, or put on his 2 prostheses, because he has no arms to turn those pages. I have worked with students who, because of either a congenital or adventitious blindness or low vision, because of multiple sclerosis or complications associated with diabetes, cannot see the print contained in this text. I've also worked with students who are not able to identify or distinguish the difference between the letter B and the letter D, or even if they can, they can't decode a word as simple as where because of a learning disability. And then I've worked with scores of students who cannot track the words across the page, so through a sentence or from line to line, because their eyes have a visual motor dysfunction. Lastly, assuming the student can pick up the book open, see the print, identify the words, decode the words, there are those students who cannot get at the meaning or comprehend the message that's contained in those written words due to a learning disability, due to a brain injury. The reason I'm here is because that I believe that Jeff Flores, the committee members, the other people in this room, even the opponents of this House bill, can relate to the struggle of these students if you understand that struggle. And by understanding that struggle, I don't think you can possibly oppose this effort, which is to eliminate, reduce, if not eliminate, the struggle of these students. And I see House Bill 2967 as doing that. So, obviously, I passionately support it. And for the record, I want you to know that my testimony is available in an e-text, alternative format, for you to access. And I really appreciate you taking these last minutes to hear me through. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, panel. Is there anyone else that wishes to give very quick testimony on House Bill?
I'd like to make a comment.
2967. You can come forward, and Representative March will make a comment.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think this is a bill has a lot of good features to it. I think obviously it needs a change to get away from the National Instructional Materials Accessibility Standard as the default, and maybe put in some alternatives like.
Brain injury. The reason I'm here is because that I believe that Chair Flores, the committee members, the other people in this room, even the opponents of this House bill, can relate to the struggle of these students if you understand that struggle. And by understanding that struggle, I don't think you can possibly oppose this effort, which is to eliminate, if not eliminate, the struggle of these students. And I see House Bill 2967 as doing that. So, obviously, I passionately support it. And for the record, I want you to know that my testimony is available in an e-text, alternative format, for you to access. And I really appreciate you taking these last minutes to hear me through. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, panel. Is there anyone else that wishes to give very quick testimony on House Bill?
I'd like to make a comment.
2967. You can come forward, and Representative March will make a comment.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think this is a bill has a lot of good features to it. I think obviously it needs a change to get away from the National Instructional Materials Accessibility Standard as the default, and maybe put in some alternatives like PDF, ASCII, Microsoft Word, maybe even been perfect to round out the realm and work with Bowie to find some find the proper housing for any appeal. But this particular piece of legislation has a lot of appeal to me.
Are you suggesting that there be some subsequent work done then to accommodate some whatever might be?
Yeah.
Okay. We will make that exploration.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My name is Lynn Lodge, and I coordinate the Alternative Format Program at Lane Community College in Eugene, Oregon. And I just would like to present to you a few figures for consideration when you go to evaluate this bill. We currently, in our Disability Services Department, have over 870 students with documented disabilities that we serve. Out of that 870 students, we have approximately 60% that qualify for alternative formatted materials. Over the 2003-04 year, our college budget, departmental budget, spent over $50,000 on staff and equipment to reformat the textbooks and the material into the format needed by the students. We reformatted over 370 books and spent over 2,000 hours in that process. 52 of those books were scanned, and it took 131 hours, and 17 books were enlarged over 40 hours. And so I just thought you might like to hear firsthand what one particular college within the state has to budget to accomplish this. And I also would like to draw your attention to the Office of Civil Rights, a suit that was settled in California at the University, Cal State University Fullerton. The Office of Civil Rights doc number is 09-03-2166. This was settled just a few months back, and a student had filed a complaint against the university system for delay of materials, e-text materials, and it was settled in favor of the student, and the college ended up with legal repercussions as a result of that. And that's all I have to say. I'm open for questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just had a comment as well. I wanted to put on the record. I agree with Representative March and that we need to get on and do some things. And I wanted to comment on our professor's comments. Being a person with dyslexia and having had the difficulty of an elementary child trying to access information, many of the groups that are out there do wonderful things for their own group of people. And it is difficult to access information from one to work with somebody else. So you have groups for the blind that put text on into books. But you can't get that from my dyslexic person over here. And as a high school principal, the ability to get materials in a timely manner for people has been really a difficult thing. I'm so pleased that the new publishing deals for the K-12 programs. But we do need to solve this problem. I understand the issue with the kinds of formats that I do, so I concur that we need to work on some way to get to move this forward, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. That's concise.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2967. No further business to come before the Education Committee. We will close the committee. Adjourned.